Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
This is a Joy 94.9 podcast presented by Paul Anthony with the assistance of the Gay and Lesbian Liaison Officers, Victoria Police, Crime Stoppers and Joy 94.9 working together to make our community safe.
The most livable city. The most lovable radio. Joy 94.9.
Paul Anthony with you on the conch with Gay and Lesbian Liaison Officer Scott Davis. Our special guest today commenced service with the Victoria Police at the tender age of 18 and a half back in 1972. Currently is superintendent within the Operations Coordination Department and has just returned from 12 months leave to take up an opportunity to work in Antarctica. Superintendent Bill De Bruin, welcome to Joy 94.9.
Afternoon, Paul. How are you going?
I'm good. The question is, though, why would you go somewhere where it's colder?
Go somewhere where it's colder? Well, there's a lot less people. And also, I didn't know, it was just a moment of insanity that sort of made me apply for it. And as it turned out, it was probably one of the greatest things that I've managed to do in my life.
Let's take a couple of steps back. You arrived from Holland and weren't even able to speak English.
No, I was a little Dutch boy with the clogs when I got off the ship in the early 60s. Like some of your listeners, sort of went through the bias stage for a number of years, but fortunately I had blue eyes and blonde hair, so I soon assimilated into the community.
How old were you when you arrived in Australia, Bill?
11.
11. So no English, and you're 11 years of age. You went through some sort of assimilation process to help you speak English and that sort of thing?
Yeah, you learn how to speak it real quick, or you got a blood nose every time you made a mistake at school. There was no ifs or buts about it.
You were just pushed off to, what, a primary school or a secondary school?
I did 6 months at a primary school.
Yep.
And then straight into a secondary school, but there was no integration as there is now or assistance. You just straight to school, not a word of English. You got dropped off at the gate and you just went from there.
How long did it take you to learn English?
Oh, I'd say a couple of months. You got no choice. It's survival or just get beaten up in the schoolyard. It really is as simple as that.
I thought you would have been off to some type of prestige school coming all the way from Holland. Where did you go?
I went to the same school as young Scott over here. It was Frankston High, but when he went, they actually had some new buildings. When I went, we had to burn it down for you to get a new school, Scott.
Right. And it got burned down again a little bit later after I left as well. Yeah.
What sort of work were you doing as you left school? Did you go straight into being a copper?
Yeah, I did. My parents had a farm, and I think they had this idea that I'd become a farmer, so having done that for a couple of weeks, I decided that was not the future for me, and at the ripe old age of 18 and a half, quickly, I think I applied for the Navy, Army and Air Force and Police all at the one time just to get away from home, and the coppers took me first.
Take us through just a little bit of the history of your policing, and then we'll get stuck into what you did down in Antarctica.
Well, the policing is just like most of my vintage that are out there. I've been operational for every single day of the 38 years that I've been in Victoria Police, sort of pretty varied. I've always tried to get to the coalface. The busier the place, the better I liked it, but policing's changed a bit since then, so you know your Dandenongs, your Frankstons, your Footscray's, your Heidelbergs. I haven't sort of looked for the latte set, so I've really enjoyed operational policing over the years.
You've worked at a variety of different places. One of the places that we do share is Hastings. What are your memories of working at Hastings Police Station?
The good ones.
Yes.
Hastings, when I was there, was a fishing village. I was there in I think 74, it might have been before you were born, Scott, when you're referring to the old coppers moving out with the recruiting. I thought you
74, I would have been 9.
Yeah. I was there for about 5 years, and it really was a fishing village. It was, you know, a few thousand people.
Yeah.
You knew absolutely everybody. You played footy in the town. You used to get beaten up at the footy because you were the local copper. But it was a great place to work, and even now when I go back to Hastings and my parents still live there,
yeah,
I could be walking down Coles and someone will call out, "Hey, Billy," and you turn around and someone that you locked up 25, 30 years ago.
I certainly think it's the best police station that I've ever worked at. It was just a fun place to work, and there was a lot of variety. And because you were fairly isolated as a police station, you had to have your wits about you all the time because you couldn't rely on there being backup.
Well, no, I disagree with that. Yeah. I got involved in a little skirmish one day in the Hastings Hotel prior to the current management, so I don't want to say that it's changed.
Yep.
And I was on the losing end of this particular skirmish, and the sailors came to my aid.
Yeah, well, that's true, that's true. Yeah, there's a lot of locals that really support their police down there.
Yeah, so by the time I woke up, and because I really had lost, the culprits were in the back of the divvy van, and the sailors were saying, where's the key? Well, we'll just lock it up for you and help me drive them back to the police station.
Yeah.
Were you about in the days when the Frankston police station was under siege?
Yeah, I was actually involved in that. That again was in the 70s, or I think about 75, 76, yeah. I can't remember now, but it was one of those unusual situations, yeah, wrong place at the wrong time, but as history goes, you know, one of 11 that was at the police station at the time.
And the Riot Act was actually read at a particular occasion. I don't know that it's ever been read in Victoria at all.
The only time that I know of, and it's probably got the widest ranging powers that, as a policeman, that I can understand, is that once the Riot Act was read, any injuries or consequence that came as a response of our actions, we were covered by law.
Mm.
You know, whether firearms were being used or batons or whatever resources we could get our hands on. Once the Riot Act is read, the onus goes onto the populace that are there to get away.
The riot actually broke down pretty quickly once the police decided to move outside of the police station, didn't it?
Yeah, it was an absolutely incredible situation. There's, like, I'm guessing, 500, 600, 700, 800 people out there chanting for the release of their drunken mate that got locked up for drunk, rocks being thrown, etc., etc. But when the 11 of us actually went outside, there was only two or three real ringleaders. Once we grabbed those, the others dispersed darn quick.
Fortunately.
One of the other things you had responsibility for was the Phillip Island Motorcycle Grand Prix. Are you into motorbikes?
I wasn't, but I've learned a lot since. Yeah, I was the inspector down at Gippsland for 10 years and then went back as a superintendent more and got another 3 years. So for 13 years, I had a large part in the planning and the organisation of the policing side of it. And I've still got a lot of friends down the island as we speak. So, yeah, over the years, I've had a beer with, I had the beer, Valentine Rossi had a Coke. I've met him, I met Derwin, I met all the main players down there. And as a result, yeah, I really learned to love the bikes and treat the guys as true sportsmen.
One of the reasons that we've sort of gone along this path is to give the understanding that you've pretty much at the pointy end of policing for most of your career. That's fair to say, isn't it?
As I said earlier, I've been operationally nearly every day.
Yeah. And then a few years ago, which is when we first met each other properly, you suddenly became in charge of my unit. You were in charge of the Gay and Lesbian Advisory Unit. What was your thoughts when that was put across to you?
And the thoughts at the time, I can't really relate on this radio at the time because it was totally out of left field for someone like me, I'm sure.
Yeah. And at the end of your term of being in charge of the area, though, had you changed?
Yeah, I think not only just being in charge of the GLOW officer and yourself, but the people that I got to deal with and the reference groups and some of the complaints that we dealt with probably made me a more tolerant person and probably made me of greater value when I went down to the Antarctic, that you accept people for what they are, not who or what they may be.
Yep.
And, yeah, it's definitely changed me. It was a large part of reforming, you know, some of the opinions that I had. And I make no secret about it. Over the years, I often went to youth suicides as a result of the youth not being quite sure, you know, which way they may have gone. Back in the early 70s, suicide was a way out for them. And now when I look back on it, I wish that we as coppers had more training back then to help us deal with those problems that are out there. We could have done so much.
Could you have seen yourself back in the 70s to think that you'd be talking now in a gay and lesbian radio station?
Oh, to be quite honest, I would have laid 1,000 to 1 against it.
Against it. Well, you've certainly come a long way. You've had 38 years of experience with Victoria Police. You've just returned from 12 months from working in Antarctica. How did you come to be working in Antarctica? Because I'm assuming you can't just, like, get a ticket and go. There's got to be some type of application process.
Yeah, I was actually flying back from Adelaide one day and there was an ad in the Qantas magazine for Australian Antarctic Division for careers down there, and that led me to sort of make a few more inquiries on the internet and their job description. The next thing, I'd applied after I sought permission from the wife, of course.
Speaking of which, it's a very remote location. What did your wife think about you spending 12 months down there, or more in a part of the world that basically where the sea freezes over, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I don't know what my wife thought, whether it was, you know, she was looking forward to that. Was actually gone for 16 months, whether it was a 16-month break or... but I think in the end she was pretty glad to get me back. I hope she's listening, so... but it was the adventure of a lifetime, but if there was a downside to it, it is absence from family and friends. But if you take that negative away from it, it was an awesome experience.
Speaking of the seas freezing over, once they do freeze over, that's it. You're kind of stuck there, aren't you, for a while?
Yeah, you're stuck from about very early March to mid-November, end of November, depending on the last ship leaves and the first ship comes in. And the ice can freeze up to any hundreds of kilometres out, up to 2-3 metres thick. So, and it really doesn't take a long time to freeze. Once it starts to freeze within days, it's hard enough to walk on.
So you could walk back? Maybe not.
No, not quite. Well, how many thousand kilometres away is... You were at Davis Base.
Yep.
It's sort of southwest of Perth?
Yeah, directly south of Perth, about 6,000 kilometres due south of Perth.
It's a long way to walk, Paul. 6,000 kilometres.
How do you get there? Because I know Australia's opened up a runway for planes to get in and out of Antarctica. Did you fly there?
No, the runways at Casey, which is for the Woosters to just fly in and out. Unfortunately, I had to take the long way on the Aurora Australis, which is an Australian icebreaker. It's only a very small little icebreaker, and unfortunately, I got so sick on the way down there. For the whole 12 months I was down there, I was dreading the experience of having to go back.
And it's not just a little short trip down there, is it?
No, on the way down, it took us 21 days.
21 days. And what sort of swells? You were talking about the... Well, give us a picture of this... I was going to say boat, but I've been corrected there. It's a ship.
Yeah, the boat is what you get in when the ship sinks, so they tell me on the...
Okay, so the Aurora Australis. What's the length of the Aurora Australis?
98 metres. So believe me, that is not very large in the Southern Ocean.
No. So what's a footy oval? You're a footy person.
Oh, that's about up to 400 metres. So okay. Really, from the centre to the centre half forward would be the boat. It's a good size ship, but not in those oceans. It's rocks. You're not on a cruise liner that's got stabilisers and the like. It really does get thrown about.
And what sort of size swells were we looking at?
Well, on the way back, we had 10-metre swells and topped up by nearly 10-metre waves on top. So we're looking at 20 metres. Now, when you consider that the front of the bow is about 7 metres above the water, I've got photographs where there's 13 metres of water coming at us higher than the ship.
Yeah, and I can imagine that if you're moving that much in the boat, there's so much swell, how do you sleep?
You don't.
Okay, yeah, for 21 days.
No, well, it's not always rough, but it's not calm either. But the only way you can get to sleep at night is to grab two bags, put them each end of your bunk, and brace yourself inside your bags. You don't sleep. 3 days in rough weather, it looks like everyone's been to the zoo with black rings around their eyes.
Yeah.
Prior to your arrival down at Davis Base, there was a bit of a medical emergency. Can you tell us what the emergency was?
Yeah, one of the expeditioners from the previous winter group that we went there to relieve unfortunately had a fairly serious quad accident, which resulted in life-threatening injuries that would not enable him to be transported back on the ship, even if we could. So as a result, the Antarctic Division contacted the Americans at their station, and the Americans, having a Hercules equipped with skis, agreed to come and rescue our expedition as long as we could build a 3-kilometre runway on the ice in front of the station for them to land on.
So you had to build the runway before they could land?
Yes, well, it didn't exist. There was no need for us to have, because we were coming in by ship. So,
But isn't it flat anyway?
Well, no, it's, you got a lot of ice, a lot of...
Icebergs get trapped in the sea ice, don't they, as well?
Well, you got rafting where the ice pushes against itself, you got a lot of snow. It has to be a perfectly straight blue ice runway for them to be able to land on.
So how do you go about building a runway down in Antarctica?
Well, we've got graders and casboras and bulldozers, and we just take them on the ice and away we go.
See, there's something about that. Bulldozers, graders, very heavy, on ice. I'd be scared they're going to break the ice and you're going to fall underneath it.
Well, during resupply, we put heavy Mack trucks on the ice, drive beside the ship, and we can take loads up to 30 tonne quite comfortably on trailers and drive it off, because the ship's still 3 kilometres offshore when we resupply.
Wow.
But at the same time, in my time down there, both the fellow stations at Russia and the Chinese all lost vehicles through the ice.
Bill, why does Australia have a base in Antarctica? What's all that about?
Well, there's multiple reasons. Science, territorial claim, of course. They're the two main reasons. We have a lot of science work that takes place over the year, predominantly summer, and a bit over the winter.
There's an Antarctic treaty, isn't there, between a number of different countries for use of those, or to have bases on the space?
There's approximately 28 stations on the Antarctic, I think a total of 22 nations. They've all agreed to the Antarctic Treaty, which is really the conduct and behaviour of what happens on the Antarctic. Australia's got a current claim of 42% of the Antarctic surface, a claim since the mid-30s.
So how many bases does Australia have down there?
We've got three, Davis, Casey and Mawson.
And there's also one on Heard Island, is it, or Macquarie?
There's one at Macquarie Island, which is sub-Antarctic.
And what would be the closest base to Davis where you were?
We were just about, let's smack in the middle of both Casey and Mawson. We're the most southern of the stations.
Yep.
The only way to get from one to the other is by light aircraft or CASA aircraft, which the Australian government has down there.
How long would it take to, say, get over to Casey?
4 to 5 hour flight, depending on the weather. But the weather conditions are so fickle down there that, for argument's sake, we tried to get a flight to Mawson when I was there last year, and it took us 5 weeks before we had a window opportunity to be able to get there and to get back.
Can you fly all year round?
No, the planes are only there over the summer period, and then they get shipped back to Australia. The helicopters go back on the last ship, and the planes fly themselves back before it gets just too cold.
So we're talking about March onwards through till November.
The end of November, yeah.
That you're completely isolated. You can't get to another base. You're it.
No, no, you can do a traverse to the other station, or nearby station. Our nearest station was Zhongchang, yep. The Chinese station. About a 3 to 4 day traverse using our vehicles would get us over there for a bit of Chinese takeaway.
Okay, and they would come and visit you?
In return, yeah. During the summer, with the helicopters, it was very common to have a foreign station drop in on a weekly basis. It's great for morale, great to get your people out of your environment and just for mixing around, because you're basically an Antarctic family down there. The nationalities fall by the wayside. You help each other all the time.
How many people would be down there at any one time?
In the summer, we averaged about 100.
At Davis Base?
At Davis, yep. And we went it for the 8.5 months with just 18 of us.
Is there much crime during the time that you're in Antarctica?
Absolutely huge. If I ever caught who was drinking my wine, no, it's unlike Crime Stoppers, there's no cash, there's no money. You want for nothing, everything's supplied. So the only crime might be occasionally they might say something behind your back, or like I said, drink a great bottle of red wine you got on the bar.
How did your 38 years of policing come in use for being down in Antarctica? Did that come into play at all?
Oh, I think it was probably the main part that why I got the job in the first place. I was a station leader, so as such, in charge of every single resource on the station, whether it be personnel, whether it be the helicopters, the ships, whatever it may be. So our operational experience in managing logistics was great, and the skills that you learn on the street dealing with the community, whether from all aspects, also gives you a pretty good understanding of your fellow man. And when you're isolated for so long, conflict resolution and understanding each other is a huge part. So, and besides that, I was also the coroner and the special constable under the federal police. So all those skills and attributes tied in fairly well with my experience.
And as the leader of the base, you'd also be responsible for allowing people to be able to let off some steam as well.
Yeah, you're responsible for everything. If they want to go off station to do a trip, or they want to organise a particular party, or they want to let off steam in a particular way, they'd have to run it past you, because you've got to make sure that it wouldn't upset the rest of the community. It's only a small community,
yep.
But it's very, very tight.
Now, one of the things I know that you did to let off a little bit of steam was to go for a swim in June.
Yeah, on the 21st, which is Midwinter's Day, 8 of us, after the doctor declared us insane, decided to get the chainsaws out and get rid of the 2 metre ice and drill a little hole and decided to have a bit of a swim. Mm.
I've seen the pictures. Your swim is literally board shorts?
Yep.
So how cold is the air temperature?
The air temperature was minus 23 on the gauge, but it was about minus 50 because we had 30 knots of wind, which multiplied.
And I would imagine that if once you jump into this hole that you've created in the sea ice, that it would be fairly cold coming back out?
Well, it was that cold that, Scott, once we took the ice block out, we continually had to use a fishnet to get rid of the ice as it was forming between swimmers. So we'd had a crust of ice within 30 seconds or 40 seconds of us jumping in.
How do you stop yourself from sinking?
They tie a rope around you because it could knock the absolute stuffings out of you when you jump in the water, because you just gasp. I can't explain to you the stupidity. And if you said, if I ever had a choice of doing it again, I'd say no. But the water itself was actually warm until you got out, and although it was minus 1.2 degrees.
And 8 of you did it?
Yep.
The others, they chose not to do it? Or?
Yeah, they saw... I went first because I'm a bit of a coward, and I thought if I went second and saw the pain on the first guy's face, I would never do it. Most of the others had decided not to. We actually get advised by the doctor in writing that what we're doing is a total stupidity. It didn't stop the doctor from going last, though. But we have to waiver off our rights, and we are told in no uncertain terms that we are risking health and life.
And there's 18 people down there. What's the makeup of sexes, male, female?
We had 17 guys and one little sister.
How does she cope in that sort of environment, that testosterone-fueled macho environment?
I was surprised how she controlled herself with us 17 spunks there.
Yes.
But it just had to be done. And it's a very difficult environment. There was no hooking up. She was a very mature lady that was there, but that would just rip your community apart if there was a bit of hooking up and it didn't last and stuff like that. So, again, you're isolated. The only place you can hide is your bedroom, especially in the winter when there's no light. You just got to think long-term rather than short-term gratification.
I'm not sure how I would cope with the 17 spunks.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Down there. I mean, they could be there now. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're down on this white ice that goes for miles and miles and miles. Normally when I go home, if I want, I can go for a walk, I can go for a kick of the footy, I can play cricket down at the nets. What do you do down there in your downtime to stop yourself from going mad?
Ditto, exactly what you did. We played footy on Anzac Day on the ice. Unfortunately, our ball blew up after 5 minutes of kicking it, and our water bottles froze and we couldn't get any water out. So we played 4 5-minute quarters. There's only 18 of us, but we did it as a tribute to the Anzacs. You can go for a walk on the ice by yourself as long as you take precautions. So nothing to stop you from going for a 10-15 kilometre walk on the ice by yourself. And it's like being in heaven. You're walking between icebergs, between the islands. It's like a no place you've ever been on this earth. So you can get out, and we have a gym, sauna, great bar.
And there's a period of time where you don't have sunlight, so can you go walking when there's no sunlight?
Well, we've got about 6 weeks of absolute darkness.
Mm-hmm.
You can go out if you want to. You've got your GPS. There is a bit of dusk where you get an opportunity, but during that 6 to 8 weeks when we've got no light, predominantly we stay in, 100% stay in. So it's a bit institutionalised because you're only stuck in your building.
Do you ever get a knock at the door from somebody you're not expecting? Like, you know, visitors that are lost? I know that sounds strange or maybe can't happen, but has it happened?
We get a lot of visitors in the summer. Prince Albert of Monaco dropped in and had a few beers with us, had a wonderful time. We had Canadians drop in for a visit. I think we had 106 official international visits while I was there. In the middle of winter, if someone knocked on the door, I'd be surprised. There are no locks at Davis. None of the doors are locked.
So you can't get locked out? Is that the idea?
You can't get locked out, but B, there's no great need for a lock on the doors. We did get a visitor. We had a big elephant seal try to get into our kitchen. He was bigger than the door, so...
he couldn't get through.
He couldn't get through, but no, there's no visitors in winter. The first visitors came via plane from Casey, and we were all lined up on the runway just wanting to see a strange face and have someone new to tell a joke to, because all the jokes had lost their value with the others.
Lost their value. What about dogs? Did you have the huskies down there? Did you get to go out on a sleigh at all?
Nah, they're all banned from the Antarctic under the treaty that we spoke about earlier. No foreign animals or species are there. The dogs, I think the last year they were there was 91. But there's a bit of an anecdotal story. They did breed the huskies on the Antarctic for convenience sake, and dogs that had been bred and had never been off the Antarctic, and you've got to remember there's no vegetation on the Antarctic other than white, white and white, they were transported to Canada and Alaska. And the first thing they did when they saw to a tree and they lifted their legs, they had explained to me the dog that had never seen a tree. So
innate behaviour, yeah.
It's probably been waiting for all that time. Oh, a tree, finally. And it didn't freeze, probably.
One of the things that would draw me to Antarctica is the Aurora Australis. What was that like to see?
The Southern Lights you're talking about.
Yeah, the Southern Lights.
Yeah, the Auroras. There's no words that can describe it. I think you've seen my photos. I used to lay on the ice with my back and just look into the sky and see these bright green, orangey, red lights jumping across the sky. And they cover the entire sky, not just a small part of it. Mm. And it really is. It's like being in a different world.
How long would they go on for?
Oh, sometimes for hours on end. It's like a wind blows them across the sky. They jump all over the place. They change colour, brightness, direction. They happen in the Arctic as well, but it's one of the few places in the world. And when they're really running, we used to have an unofficial notification system that someone saw them, because, you know, they'd come out unexpectedly. We would ring everybody in the station, or we'd get the bing-bong going, the lights are out, and there'd be 18 of us there with our cameras for hours on end.
It would be a real photographer's paradise as well, I'd imagine. Wildlife, penguins, seals.
You cannot take a bad photo in the Antarctic. The atmosphere is so clear. Of course, your camera freezes up after 30 seconds, so you've got to set it once for distance, and then it freezes up and your battery lasts about 5 minutes. But you carry a dozen spare batteries in your pocket.
Ever get sick of the colour white?
Yeah, and that's why we have fancy dress on a lot of nights. A lot of your listeners would have a ball down there, I assure you. Even I got dressed up in stuff that, Scott, you wouldn't believe.
No, I think I would. Over the years that I've known you, you've changed quite considerably. I think I could see it happening now.
I could just imagine drag shows down in Antarctica.
Would you go back?
Personally, yes, but for my family, no. So I had an absolute wonderful experience. I was like one of the very few fortunate to have done it. Like, as I explained to you, in the middle of winter, there's less than 1,000 people on the Antarctic in total, in a landmass twice the size of Australia. So you can just imagine the experience that I've had down there. It's something that I'll cherish for the rest of my life, and Victoria Police is an organisation that gave me the chance to go.
Yeah.
What was it like coming back to the mainland from being there in 12 months? Had much changed? Had you changed?
I think I've changed. I think my tolerance for others has increased dramatically. As Scotty will probably tell you, I don't tolerate fools. But down there, there's only 18 of us, but it's such a diverse group that you have to learn and respect everyone's view and their opinion and their intelligence and their bias. And the biggest thing that I found coming back is you have to pay for things. You know, coffees, beers, they were all supplied for nothing, and all of a sudden you go in the bar and the guy says, oh, that'll be $21 for the four beers. You know, like, I said, I didn't want to buy the pub.
Yes. Do you encourage something like this? I guess it's a question that, you know, you're going to say yes to this, but what's the advice you can give to someone who's thinking about doing a trek like this?
Well, the first advice is, if you haven't got your partner's support, don't even think about it. Separation, divorce and the Dear John letters for people in the Antarctic is such a large part of life, because some go down there for the wrong reasons. If you've got a young family, don't think about it. And if you've got any health problems, don't think about it, because they will not accept you with any health problems whatsoever. The testing of your medical condition and your mental condition was a huge part. And therefore, you know, before anyone gets an idea, I'm going to go down there and work, if you don't satisfy those three ticks, don't even think about it, because you're only going to get disappointed.
How could people find out more information about it?
It's on the website, on the Antarctic Division. I think you've got the website open there now.
I do, yes. aad.gov.au, the Australian Antarctic Division. And there's a whole heap of information on there if you'd like to get across to have a look at that.
And all types of occupations are there. Crane drivers, storemen, chefs, most important the chef, doctors, electricians, all types, radio operators. Paul, you can get a job down there if you like. It's open for everyone.
Where to from here for you?
Well, I've come back actually rejuvenated. It's, you know, 16 months break from after 38 years of policing. I feel like I've got a bit to offer Victoria Police. I think I'm bringing some extra skills back with me that I've learnt down there. So let's move on from here. And if not, well, we'll see where we go. But I've come back with absolutely new enthusiasm. And the break was really good. So there's others out there listening who have those skills. The Antarctic Division is a very equal opportunity employer, and I'd be only too glad to hear from you.
Not sure why you'd want to go somewhere where it's colder.
The adventure, Paul.
Yes. Superintendent Bill De Bruin, thank you so much for joining us here on Joy.
My pleasure, and Scott, good luck with these.
Thank you.
Joy.
94.9.
If you have any knowledge concerning any crime, call Crime Stoppers on 1800 333 000 or visit crimestoppers.com.au. If it's an emergency, always call 000.
The Victoria Police GLOWS, Crime Stoppers and Joy 94.9, working together to help make our community safe.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with joy.